Chapter 25 will be covering endocrine pathology. Now, you will be covering endocrine pathology in other areas, especially biochemistry. I'm going to hit it from the pathologic point of view. And we're going to start and go organ system to organ system. We're going to start with the thyroid gland first. One of the most common disorders of the thyroid is called multinodular goiter, also known as non-toxic goiter. It's most common in women. It tends to be asymptomatic, and it's usually euthyroid in most cases. Women usually come in with a goiter. When you palpate the thyroid, it's enlarged. It tends to have multiple nodules throughout the thyroid. On microscopic exam, you'll see nodules of various sizes that are composed of colloid follicles. You can also see lots of degenerative changes. You'll see hemorrhage, calcification, cystic change, and fibrosis as well. Under laboratories, everything is normal. T3, T4, TSH, completely normal. Let's move on to hyperthyroidism. Let's talk about the general features of hyperthyroidism. Clinically, with all the thyroid hormones circulating around, patients tend to be hypermetabolic, meaning they have tachycardia, they have palpitations, they tend to be very nervous, they can have a lot of sweating, they're very heat intolerant. They can have diarrhea, and they can have weight loss even though they're eating well. They're hypermetabolic. In the laboratory, characteristic is an elevated free T4 level. What else will you see? Well, the TSH will be abnormal. If it's primary hyperthyroidism, it tends to be decreased. Secondary and tertiary hyperthyroidism tends to have an elevated TSH. Okay, let's talk about Graves' disease. This is an autoimmune disease, which is characterized by the production of an IgE antibody, which is directed against the TSH receptor. It binds to it and it stimulates it, resulting in hyperthyroidism. Let's talk about the clinical features. This is an autoimmune disease, so it's most common in females. They are hyperthyroid. They tend to have an enlarged thyroid, a goiter. They also have a very unique change in the eye. They call it exophthalmos. The eyes tend to be protuberant. It looks like they're staring out at you. Characteristic finding for Graves' disease. Another characteristic finding is they tend to develop pretibial myxedema. It's basically an increase in connective tissue in front of the tibia. It feels really doughy and edematous. Okay, under the microscope, you will see hyperplastic follicles, which have scalloped colloid. Okay, some other causes of hyperthyroidism. Multinodular goiter can rarely be toxic, meaning giving you hyperthyroidism. Another thing that gives you hyperthyroidism is a toxic or functional adenoma. Again, pretty uncommon. Most common cause of hyperthyroidism in the United States is Graves. Let's move on to hypothyroidism. Let's talk about some of the general clinical features. These patients are in a hypometabolic state, so they tend to be very lethargic, very fatigued. They tend to be very sensitive to cold temperatures. They have a decreased cardiac output, and they tend to develop myxedema. They develop in a number of unusual locations. They develop it in the face, especially around the eyes. They develop it in the hands and feet. They can develop a deep, throaty voice. And finally, they develop a very enlarged tongue, macroglossia. What else? They're hypometabolic, so they can have constipation, and they can also have problems with their menstrual cycles. In the laboratory, they have decreased levels of free T4, and the TSH is also abnormal. If it's primary hypothyroidism, the TSH will be elevated. It will be lower in secondary and tertiary forms. Let's talk about the most common cause of hypothyroidism in the United States. It's you and me. That's right, it's physicians. It's called iatrogenic hypothyroidism. Basically, we remove the thyroid, or we destroy the thyroid by radioactive iodine. That's the most common cause of hyperthyroidism. How do you treat that? You have to give hormone replacement. Okay, let's move on to thyroiditis. For thyroiditis, the big one is Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Again, this is an autoimmune disease, so it's much more common in women than men. It also is a pretty common cause of hypothyroidism. It basically wipes out the gland. Now, women will come in, they'll present with an enlargement of the thyroid, a goiter. They will tend to be hypothyroid. Initially, it could be hyperthyroidism because of all the inflammation releasing all the thyroid hormone. But eventually, it almost always winds up as hypothyroidism. Grossly, the thyroid tends to look very pale because you have all those white cells. Under the microscope, you'll see two things. You'll see a tremendous amount of lymphocytes with germinal follicles, and you'll also see a change to the epithelium. They call that Hürthle cell change. The cells just become enlarged and very pink, a lot of abundant cytoplasm. Okay, two other things I want you to remember about Hashimoto's is, first of all, it's associated with other autoimmune diseases. So the patient may also have rheumatoid arthritis. They may have scleroderma and so forth. The other complication is these patients are at increased risk of developing a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Okay, two other types of thyroiditis I want you to keep in your mind. The boards usually use these as choices. I do not want you to pick these choices unless they give you this exact description. For subacute thyroiditis, this is a granulomatous thyroiditis. Clinically, the women will come in. They tend to have an enlarged thyroid after a viral infection. So they got a history of a preceding viral infection. The gland will be tender. It will be enlarged. They may have a transient hyperthyroidism, and if you biopsy the gland, you'll see granulomas. Okay? Do not make the diagnosis unless you see the granulomas. Next one that they use as the distractor is Riedel's thyroiditis. This is a very rare disease. It's a fibrosing thyroiditis. In fact, the entire thyroid becomes rock hard. Feels like wood. And actually, the fibrosis not only involves the thyroid, but it actually will wrap around the trachea. And these patients will come in with basically respiratory insufficiency. Okay, who gets it? It tends to be women more commonly than men, and it may mimic cancer because it's actually invading other tissues. Again, do not pick it unless they give you that exact description. Let's move on to thyroid neoplasia. Specifically, the board likes to talk about the malignant thyroid cancers. So let's start off with the most common. It's called papillary carcinoma of the thyroid. It accounts for about 80% of all malignant thyroid neoplasms. Again, it's more common in women than men. And one big risk factor is patients who are exposed to radiation, like atomic bombs, nuclear reactors, and so forth. Now, microscopically, these tumors tend to have a papillary appearance. They also tend to have dystrophic calcification, which sort of has a lamellar appearance. We call these somoma bodies. Now, the tumor cells themselves tend to have very unique nuclear features. The nucleus tends to be cleared. In fact, they say it looks like an orphan Annie nuclei, because the center is completely optically clear. The other change is within the nucleus, there tends to be grooves, basically lines across the nucleus. And finally, within the nucleus, you may see cytoplasmic inclusions. It's basically the cytoplasm invaginating into the nucleus. Now, what's the prognosis for papillary carcinoma? Well, it's excellent. Even if the tumor has metastasized the cervical lymph nodes, you can usually treat it with resection and radioactive iodine. In fact, if you look at the prognosis, it's excellent. The 20-year survival is 90%. If you had to get a malignant tumor, this is the one to get. Let's talk about follicular carcinoma. It's less common. It's slightly more aggressive because how does it spread? It spreads via hematogenous means. So obviously its prognosis is going to be a little bit worse. Next in your handout is medullary carcinoma. The board likes this one. They can ask you about where does it arise from. It arises from the C cells. It can ask you what hormone is being produced by this tumor. The answer would be calcitonin. And finally, they can ask you what syndromes is this associated with. It tends to be associated with multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome type 2 and type 3. Okay, let's move on to the last type of carcinoma. This is the most aggressive. It's called anaplastic carcinoma of the thyroid. It presents in women as large, bulky masses, which basically wrap around the trachea and the esophagus. These people will come in with dyspnea. They'll come in with trouble swallowing. This is one of the most aggressive tumors in mankind. Patients, when you make the diagnosis of this, they barely survive months. Like 6 months is a long time to go with this tumor. Very, very aggressive. Okay, let's switch glands and move on to the parathyroid gland. Let's talk about primary hyperparathyroidism. Let's look at the etiology. The most common etiology is a parathyroid adenoma. It's found in about 80%. It could be associated with MEN type 1 and type 2. The next etiology is parathyroid hyperplasia. This is hyperplasia of more than one gland. And finally, I want you to remember paraneoplastic syndromes. Lung cancer, renal cancer, both can produce PTH and give you primary hyperparathyroidism. Now let's look at the etiology, the pathogenesis. The pathogenesis is excessive production of PTH leading to hypercalcemia. Clinically, you're going to have elevated levels of calcium and PTH. With all this calcium circulating around, these patients tend to develop calcium kidney stones, which, as you remember, are quite painful. The other thing that they can develop is, since they're taking the calcium from the bones, they tend to develop osteoporosis. And in fact, it can get so severe, we call it osteitis fibrosa cystica. The bones basically become cystic and fibrotic. Two other changes I want you to be aware of is, since you have so much calcium circulating around your body, it can deposit in various organs and give you what's called metastatic calcifications. The final thing is, since you have so much calcium circulating around, you can have neurologic problems. Okay, I only want to say one word about secondary hyperparathyroidism. It's usually due to chronic renal failure. Okay, let's move on to hypoparathyroidism. For this one, let's look at the etiology. In the United States, the most common cause is, again, you and me. When we remove the thyroid gland, a lot of times we remove the parathyroid by accident. So surgical resection is probably the most common cause. Another common cause is DeGeorge's syndrome. Remember, that's failure of development of the third and fourth pharyngeal pouches. Let's look at the clinical features. These patients tend to have hypocalcemia. They develop neuromuscular excitability. They can have tetany. They can develop cardiac conduction defects. In fact, on the EKG, you often see a prolongation of the QT interval. And finally, how do you treat these patients? You give them vitamin D and calcium. Let's now move to the pituitary gland. Talk about pituitary adenomas. Remember, the pituitary gland has multiple cell types within it. So it depends on which cell type is proliferating. If the tumor is of the prolactin-producing tumors, we call it a prolactinoma. This is the most common type. It produces prolactin, and clinically these patients present with a nipple discharge. They call that galactorrhea. They can also have amenorrhea and infertility as well. The next type is a growth hormone producing adenoma. These tumors are going to produce growth hormone. They're also going to produce elevation in insulin-like growth factor, somatostatin C. In children, this leads to gigantism. Their growth plates haven't fused yet, so the long bones get really long and they turn into giants. If this tumor develops in an adult, after his growth plates have fused, they develop what's called acromegaly. They get very prominent foreheads. The jaws become very protuberant. The hands and the feet enlarge. Those are the characteristic features of acromegaly. Some other tumors that you may hear about, if the tumor produces ACTH, we call it a corticotrope-producing adenoma. That will lead to Cushing's disease. And the other one that's important is a thyrotrope adenoma, producing TSH. That will lead to hyperthyroidism. Let's move on to Sheehan syndrome. The classic clinical presentation for this will be a woman who has a very difficult delivery. She becomes hypotensive. And what happens is the pituitary becomes ischemic. In fact, it infarcts and becomes necrotic. And basically, she develops hypopituitaryism. That's the classic presentation of Sheehan syndrome. Next one I want you to remember is in patients who have head trauma or head tumors. It's called diabetes insipidus. By definition, you have an ADH deficiency resulting in polyuria, polydipsia, and hypernatremia. Okay, let's continue now with the endocrine pathology system. We're going to move to the adrenal gland. For this, we need to talk about Cushing syndrome, high yield for the exam. By definition, there's going to be an increased levels of glucocorticoids. What's the etiology? Well, there are four major etiologies. The first one is iatrogenic. It's you and me handing out steroids. Probably the most common cause in the United States. What are some other causes? Well, on the exam, they love to give an adrenal cortical adenoma, which produces glucocorticoids. When you have that, we call that Cushing's disease, and the adenoma will produce the ACTH. So in the serum, the ACTH is elevated. The interesting thing is if you do a high-dose dexamethasone suppression test, you will be able to suppress cortisol. Let's contrast that with adrenal cortical adenoma. This produces cortisol. You'll have a decrease in ACTH, and there will be no cortisol suppression with dexamethasone. Finally, you can have a paraneoplastic syndrome. Especially remember small cell tumors of the lung love to produce ACTH. That will give you an elevation of serum ACTH, and there'll be no cortisol suppression with dexamethasone. Let's now move on to a tumor of the adrenal cortex, which produces mineralocorticoids. We call that Kahn syndrome. It produces aldosterone. Clinically, these patients tend to present with hypertension. On the lab exam, you'll see hypokalemia. You'll also see elevations in aldosterone and a decrease in renin. Let's now move to a adrenal cortical tumor which produces androgens. We call this the adrenal genital syndrome. By definition, the adrenal tumor produces excess androgens, which results in virilization. I want you to remember congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Remember your biochemistry. The most common cause is 21-hydroxylase deficiency. Okay, let's move on to Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, also known as acute adrenal insufficiency. This usually occurs in children who have an infection with a Neisseria organism. These patients tend to get very, very sick. They can develop DIC. They develop hypertension and shock. And the problem, or actually the pathology, is that both of the adrenals undergo hemorrhagic infarction. They basically get wiped out, and you have acute adrenal insufficiency. It's usually fatal, life-threatening. Let's move on to Addison's disease. This is the chronic form of adrenal insufficiency. By definition, you've destroyed the adrenal cortex, leading to a deficiency in aldosterone, androgens, and also glucocorticoids. Let's talk about the etiology. The most common cause in the United States is autoimmune. The second most common cause is tuberculosis. In fact, before we had anti-tuberculosis medications, tuberculosis used to be the number one cause. It's got a great tropism for the adrenal gland. And if it destroys the adrenal gland bilaterally, you'll develop Addison's. The last possible cause is a metastatic carcinoma. Remember that lung cancer loves to metastasize to the adrenal gland. If it does bilaterally, destroying both adrenal glands, you'll develop Addison's disease. How does this patient present? Well, they tend to have a gradual onset of weakness. They tend to get hyperpigmentation of the skin, hypotension, loss of libido, and a poor response to stress. How do you treat these patients? Well, you got to replace the steroids. You put them on steroid replacement. Let's talk about tumors of the adrenal medulla. The big one is a pheochromocytoma. This is an incredibly rare tumor in life. but it's very common on the exam. Now, how do these patients present? Well, the tumor produces catecholamines, epinephrine and norepinephrine. So they tend to present with severe headaches, hypertension. They may say to you, "Doc, my heart feels like it's pounding outside of my chest," palpitations. They also tend to have hypertensive episodes. I want you to remember the rule of 10s for pheo. 10% occur in children, 10% are bilateral, 10% arise outside the adrenal gland, 10% are malignant, and 10% are associated with the multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome, type 2 and type 3. How do you make the diagnosis of a pheochromocytoma? Well, you look in the urine for VMA. That's the breakdown product of catecholamines. Let's move on to the multiple endocrine neoplasia syndromes. These are syndromes that are autosomal dominant, and they're characterized by hyperplasia and neoplasia of the endocrine organs. There are three major types. The first type is called MEN1. It's also known as Wormer's syndrome. The way I remember this one is by remembering the four P's. What are the four P's? Well, let's start from the head and count down. The endocrine organ at the base of the brain that starts with a P is called the pituitary. They develop pituitary adenomas. That's the first P. The next P occurs in the neck, the parathyroid gland. They develop parathyroid adenomas. That's the second P. For the third P, we move down to the endocrine organ that's down in the retroperitoneum in the abdomen. That's the pancreas. They tend to develop pancreatic adenomas. Those pancreatic adenomas tend to produce gastrin, so we call them gastrinomas. The last P is because of the pancreatic gastrinoma. It produces gastrin. Gastrin increases the acidity in the stomach, leading to intractable peptic ulcers. That's the fourth P. So that's how I remember MEN type 1. For MEN type 2, it's also known as 2A or Sippel syndrome. Now, I like to remember type 2 and type 3 together because they're pretty similar. What do they both have in common? Well, they both have in common pheochromocytomas. They also have in common a tumor of the thyroid. It's a medullary carcinoma. So now, you need to add one to each of them to make them unique. So what do I add to 2? I usually add hyperplasia of the parathyroid gland or parathyroid adenomas. What do you add to type 3? Usually you add mucosal neural tumors like neurofibromas, and that's what makes it different. That concludes the endocrine pathology section.